Welcome back. I'm Erin, and Ethan is here. And this episode is about keying in on the timeline of Monday, February 9th, 2004. And in this episode, we're going to cover from 3:32 a.m. to 4:37 p.m. And I guess I should put out a trigger warning for those who seem to get a little worked up whenever the timeline is brought up.
Yep. One thing that happens, I find, in a lot of places is once someone writes something down and publishes it and puts it out there, then everyone comes out of the woodwork. It's like, wait a minute, that's completely not what I thought. And so that's exactly what happened. I mean, we did the same thing. Like, I looked at their timeline. And I'm like, excuse me, what? So like, yeah, like someone's got to publish something and say like, this is the timeline. And then you find out we don't all agree on that.
Yeah. Yeah. So maybe we should start with why it's important to begin with, because I think that's where the first argument or disagreement sort of is. Some people just don't think it's important.
Yeah.
Or don't think it's worth all of the discussion, to put it mildly.
Right, right. Like, people might say, like, why worry about a minute or two or three or four here or there? Like, what does it matter? But if you don't already assume you know what happened, then to me, it puts constraints on what could have happened. So it's very important, you know, depending on the sequencing of events and when they occurred, there's different scenarios that are possible.
Right.
Or it could even point to things you haven't thought of, maybe.
Exactly. Yeah, that's why I think it's important. Like, whatever happened to Maura happened within the time period between 7:27 and 7:46.
Yeah.
So, of course, you would want to figure out what's possible and what's not possible based on certain ranges of time that we can say with some degree of certainty about. So my timeline for the day starts at 3:32 a.m. and ends at 9:35 p.m. And this is just Monday, February 9th.
Mm-hmm. Now, why did you choose to start Monday morning and not like sooner? Why not go back to like her car accident and her the weekend and the party and all that?
I don't think that that's irrelevant, but I really want to focus in on what she did that day.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, the farther you get from the day, the more likely you'll run into events that are completely unrelated to what happened to her. And you don't necessarily know what is and is not going to be related, but probably things that happened closer to her disappearance are more likely to be relevant to it. So we're starting at 3:32 on Monday.
Yes. So we actually have a copy of the email Maura sent to her nursing cohort, and it was titled Maternity Clinic Definitions, and it was sent at 3:32 a.m. and 38 seconds. And I mean, I don't want to speculate too much about her sleep habits, but it does seem like she kind of stayed up late and woke up late.
It's kind of a night owl.
Yeah. So I assume that she hadn't gone to bed yet, and not that she woke up at 3:32 in the morning.
Yeah. If it was my records from college, that would be 100% what happened.
Yeah.
It was not unusual for me to go to bed at 3 or 4 in the morning. What was she looking up?
Maternity terms.
Maternity terms.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know, the way that it's sort of been represented, I think, is almost like, was she Googling, like, what are early pregnancy symptoms?
Right, like, on behalf of herself.
Yeah, but actually, it was more like Braxton Hicks and, like, these very technical medical terms associated with pregnancy.
Right, yeah, and we've talked about this 1,000 times, but it's just definitely helpful to always bring it up again, the theories about potential pregnancy that are seemingly baseless.
Yeah, 100% baseless. There is literally no evidence and only evidence to the contrary.
Yeah.
But because I think that this has been such a sticking point, I do think it's important to just play a quick clip of Julie Murray's interview with the captain on True Crime Garage, because she lays it out pretty clearly.
I mean, this is the misinformation that gets put out there. So you're telling me that she's not pregnant and your father's not paying for her to start a new life?
Yes, I can't believe I have to say this. Yes, that's what I'm saying. The $4,000 was to buy her a car that actually ran with all cylinders firing. And I have to address it. I can't believe I do. But the rumor about the pregnancy is that her computer showed searches for pregnancy terms, maternity terms. Mm-hmm. And that's because she was going through a maternity cycle. And so her literal homework was to look up maternity terms.
Julie, that sounds a little too convenient.
I mean, it's not a good story. It's not salacious. Yeah. And also she was on birth control and she had 4 pills missing out of her current pack of birth control.
Right. That was one of the items found in her car.
So that was Julie on True Crime Garage. And she obviously also mentioned the $4,000. Mm-hmm. So just to be clear, like I'm looking at the clinical information for undergraduate nursing majors at UMass. They have very strict requirements. Everything from your shoes and your uniform to the way that your hair has to be maintained to reliable transportation. That is one of the 3 requirements, like absolute requirements, is reliable transportation. Students are required to provide their own transportation to clinical and community sites. And this gets to why was it so important for Fred to be there the weekend before and to help her buy a new car? Because it was necessary for her program. Not because he like wanted her to have a way to get to and from Stop and Shop more easily.
Right.
It was because she was required to have her own private transportation as a part of the curriculum in the nursing program.
Yeah. All right. And now we have a big gap.
Yeah. So I assume that she probably went to bed sometime after that. And the next thing on the timeline isn't about Maura. It's actually a call that Bill made at 11 a.m. to Maura, and he ended up leaving a voicemail. She didn't pick up, possibly because she was still asleep.
Yeah, she was up 7 hours before that, so plausible she was still asleep.
And by the way, these times are all in Eastern Standard local times.
Okay.
Oklahoma is, I think, on Central, but it would be way too confusing to explain, like, Bill's time versus Maura's time. Like, I'm just going to put everything in Eastern Standard time.
Okay.
After that, so 12:55, that's when she calls Linda Salamone.
Linda Salamone is?
She is the woman who owns condos in the Bartlett, New Hampshire area. Mm-hmm. Linda did not remember talking to Maura because the police never spoke to her.
Right.
And by the way, the police, when they were questioned about why they didn't call Linda Salamone, they said because their investigation was going in a different direction at the time.
Oh, it's going in a different direction. So you just don't follow other leads. You just let those languish.
Yeah, which is unfortunate.
Yeah.
But all she remembers, or all she could say for sure, is that she did not rent her a condo.
Right.
Now, one thing that might be relevant to point out is that this was the condo that she had stayed at for several days in July of the previous year when she was up there visiting the White Mountains with Fred and Bill.
Okay.
So I think that's interesting because, well, I don't know if we want to bring the speeding ticket into or not, but if that's where she was staying when she got the speeding ticket, maybe that's why it was the first place that she thought to go.
Hmm. Certainly it was a place she knew about.
Yes.
And had been to, what was that, 9 months before? Something like that?
7. Yeah. Now, one thing that's been put out there on more than a couple of occasions is that Maura was looking for a 2-bedroom condo or hotel. Therefore, she must have been traveling with someone.
I said, Linda, you know, what can you tell me about this rental place? And she said, oh, it's very interesting that she was asking about that one because it wasn't a single. The hotel room Maura wanted was a double.
She's driving past Nootka Lodge, which had nice single rooms. She's searching for condos in places with more than one bedroom. So that to me says she's not traveling alone either. But then she doesn't find a place, right? The reason is she's working with somebody else. She's got a friend there that's also looking for reservations. This friend is the one that actually made the reservations.
But I don't know why one would assume that because someone inquires about a 2-bedroom that they are exclusively looking for a 2-bedroom.
Well, if you find out that it was a 2-bedroom condo and you stop asking any questions, then that's how you get there.
Right. I'm definitely understanding of that. But what I'm not understanding of is seeing that somebody called one place looking for a reservation. One place. And from that information, you're saying that they were exclusively looking for two-bedroom condos. And then from that point, attaching even more assumptions and coming to the conclusion that there had to have been another person, which, by the way, if it's a person who is so close to you that they're going to hold on to your secrets for 16 years, but you can't stay in the same hotel room together.
Yeah. And she has, like, almost no money. It's ludicrous.
It just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Now, the reality is that she'd already stayed there before in the past. It was a place that she was familiar with. And Sharon Rausch, on the Disappeared show, she explained how the condo that Maura called about was the cheapest one that Linda owned.
Linda and her husband own a condo in Bartlett, New Hampshire. And Fred and Maura and Billy had stayed there in late summer of 2003. At the time that I learned this, I went online, and this condo by the Salamones was the least expensive to rent. So I'm confident that that is why that Maura chose that one.
This 12:55 p.m. call on February 9th, 2004 lasts 3 minutes. Unfortunately, Linda Salamone is unable to remember more about her conversation with Maura because she is contacted so many months afterwards.
So that clip was from the Disappeared episode that aired in 2009, and it was Sharon Rausch explaining that the reason Maura was looking at that particular hotel was because it was the cheapest one.
Yeah. Well, it was cheap, but also, like, she called a place specifically that she'd been before. Maybe she prefers to stay somewhere she's a little more familiar with.
Exactly.
I know people who do this. They know a place that they stayed, and they are like, oh, I'll stay there. And that's, like, their idea of how you find lodging. And it's pretty common. To me, I'm like, no, shop around. You always got to find, you know, maybe there's a deal somewhere else. But, like, a lot of people are like, no, I stayed there. I'll call them out. Maybe they have a room. You know? Like, clearly that's a plausible explanation.
It's also, we have to remember, this is not 2020. This is 2004. This is before the explosion of things like hotels.com.
Right.
It was very common. In fact, I remember doing this in college. You would just drive to a place and look at the sign, see if they had vacancy. And most of the time, they actually had the rate, like, listed right there on the sign. And the only real criteria I would have is if it had a AAA sign, if it's AAA rated.
Yep.
That was basically the only condition back in the day.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that was how it was through all history until the last 10 or 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So if you had a lead on a place, there was a very high likelihood you were going to end up there, whether it was necessarily the cheapest or the most appropriate for your needs that time.
Right. There was really no alternative.
Yeah. That's also a really good point to answer the question of, like, well, but she didn't get that room. But then, like, what did she do? Well, she probably went to her backup plan of, like, well, I'll just stay at a place that has a vacancy then.
Exactly. And I think, you know, North Conway is right next to Bartlett.
Mm-hmm.
So perhaps she was just going to head to North Conway, you know, drive up the strip. It's like one road, and look for a hotel. And if she can't find anything there, she could always just continue on home.
Yeah.
I think one of the other things is, why didn't she just stop at the Newt Collage? That's a nice place that has one bedrooms. Well, she drove past that. Clearly her destination was somewhere east. So probably for the same reason that she didn't stop at the Comfort Inn in Hadley, her destination was not Woodsville. It also wasn't Hadley. But I've heard this repeated over and over, and it's so annoying.
That is very annoying.
All right, so the next thing is Maura emailed Bill at 1 p.m. exactly, and I presume this is a response to the fact that she wakes up, she sees that Bill tried calling her, so she emails him. The subject is, hey, hey, and she says, I love you more, stud. I got your messages, but honestly, I didn't feel like talking to much of anyone. I promise to call today, though. Love you, Maura. So that was 1 p.m., and by the way, this is really the only communication that we have between the two at this point. And she says, I love you, twice.
Hmm. Yeah.
Anyway. So the next thing is at 1:13 p.m., Maura called Erin Murphy, who was the nursing student that she was friends with and that had been giving her rides. It was only the second week of school, but had driven her to clinicals the week before. And she wanted to return clothing that she'd borrowed when they sort of got stuck in a snowstorm the week before. And rather than going back to UMass before they went to their second clinicals the next morning, Maura borrowed some of Erin's clothes, which were corduroys and a white sweater.
Okay. So who spoke to Erin?
Terry O'Connell.
Okay.
I actually have exactly what she told him in her own words. Okay, so she had called Erin twice. They were both two-minute calls. So this was Monday. This was the afternoon that she disappeared. She said she was going home for a family emergency. When I asked her if everything was all right, she said no. I asked her what happened, and she said, quote, my sister, and stopped. I felt that she was uncomfortable with the subject, so I said, you don't have to tell me, but if you want to talk, I'm here. She then told me she wanted to return the clothes she had borrowed before. She insisted on returning them before she left. I told her, all right, but if you changed your mind and didn't want to, that was fine. I put on a movie from the movie channel at school, and it was some Disney movie, and I fell asleep. I remember hearing a knock at the door, but couldn't wake up. When I did eventually wake up to go to the bathroom, I found a plastic bag on the floor in front of my door. It was my clothes Maura had dropped off. So it sounds like she was trying to tell Erin that there was like a family emergency, but didn't really want to talk about it, didn't want to expound. And when Erin probed for a second there, she said my sister and then stopped. I do think it's interesting that she mentioned her sister, but that could also just be a way of not answering the question at all.
Well, yeah. Well, and Erin asked, so she's got to say something. I mean, she did have a situation with her sister, so maybe she was thinking about it. You know, you don't want to talk about it. There's something going on with my sister. I'll say that. It's easier than explaining, like, that I have a whole bunch of shit going on in my life right now.
Yeah, yeah. It could also just be that she told Erin that she had a family emergency because Erin is going to be in the classes that she's missing. And if Erin walks in and says, no, actually, she took off to go skiing or took off for X, Y, and Z.
Yeah. And she emailed the professors shortly after this. It was like a few minutes later, right?
Yeah. 10 minutes later, 1:24 p.m., she emailed her professors and said there was a death in the family or a family emergency. It's a little bit unclear. And would be away for the week. I mean, to me, it just sounds like she's looking for an excuse to get away for a few days or do whatever she's going to do that's going to be consistent. She doesn't want to tell one thing to Erin and have it be a completely different thing than she tells to her professors, who could then make a comment during class. And then Erin's like, huh, that's not what Maura told me. Especially because she wouldn't be able to say to her professors, at least, that, oh, I have to leave because I need to do X, Y, and Z so that I can get back and I can buy a car, when she was already supposed to have had a car.
Mm.
So the next thing on the timeline is that at 2:05 p.m., Maura called 1-877-GO-STOW, and it was a one-minute call, and reportedly she wasn't able to get through to anyone because the lines were down. I haven't been able to independently verify that, but, you know, the fact that it was a one-minute call, it seems pretty unlikely that she would have had time to have any real conversation with somebody, especially because it was a pre-recorded line.
Now, what is GO-STOW? Because to me, that's like a storage place.
It's one of those old school 1-800 numbers where you could call to get, like, you know, the hotel listings in the area and hear about the weather and what slopes are open or closed.
Right. You'd see the commercial like, oh, come visit us and such right. and such. Call 1-800-GO-STOW. And yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Now, I will point out that Stowe is in Vermont and closer to the Burlington, Vermont area than to the Bartlett, New Hampshire area. So to me, that could be a data point against the speeding ticket theory, because it was sort of in the opposite direction. On the other hand, if she wanted to head north, but perhaps wanted to minimize the time that she was driving in New Hampshire, because technically it would have been illegal for her to be driving in New Hampshire, but not illegal to be driving in Vermont, that could be why she considered it. But the bottom line is we don't know why she called Gusto. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the next couple of things are all related.
Okay.
It's like a 10-minute span of time where there's a bunch of calls that happen. So at 2:15 p.m., Bill calls Maura, and she doesn't pick up, and he leaves her a voicemail. At 2:18 p.m., Maura calls back Bill. So 3 minutes later, she calls him back. He doesn't answer because at the same time, he's trying to call Kate Markopoulos at her dorm and on her cell phone. So he doesn't pick up. He doesn't get the call. And Maura leaves him a very brief voicemail that just says, sorry, I missed your call. I'll talk to you later. At that point, after he listens to his voicemail at 2:19 p.m. and hears Maura and that it was her that just called, he attempts to call her back several times at 2:21, 2:22, and 2:24. And just to be clear, he made 8 calls to Maura that day from 11 a.m. to 11:37 p.m. In that span of time, he calls her a total of 8 times. Mm-hmm. 1 in the morning, 4 in that 10-minute window between 2:15 and 2:24.
Yeah, which is all the same attempt, really, I would say.
Right, and then 3 in the evening. So I mention this because there's all this talk about how many times Bill was trying to call her on the 9th. 8 calls really isn't that many, especially when 4 are in rapid succession.
Yeah. Well, he clearly really wants to talk to her. And she tries to call him, but they just can't. They don't quite connect.
Right. Mind you, he has not spoken to her since she got into the accident.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just trying to put myself in his position. And I'm like, what the fuck are you supposed to do? Because, like, you're in a relationship with this person and, like, you care about them. You left them a message. They called you back, but you missed them because you were calling somebody else. So like, oh, crap, she tried to call me. Like, now you're trying to get back because you're like, I just need to talk to her for like 5 minutes, you know, like.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure he's trying to check in to make sure that she's okay because she was really upset the last time that they'd spoken.
It sounds like he's being a friggin' responsible, like, caring person.
Mm-hmm. So, next on for that day, it brings us to 3:15 p.m., which is when Maura visited the ATM, the Fleet ATM, in the Big Y Plaza in Amherst at the intersection of Route 9 and University Drive. We know that time because it was time-stamped at 3:15 on the ATM photos. And one side note about that, and one thing that I don't think I've mentioned publicly, but when I interviewed Fred, I asked him about Maura's credit and debit cards, and if she had a debit card, because, again, this was 2004, and debit cards were kind of relatively new. Like, people had mostly used ATM cards, which are different. You can't use them every place that you can use debit cards and credit cards like you can now. So often people had to, like, actually get out cash. And he wasn't positive, but he thinks she had an ATM card, not a debit card. And so I say that because it might explain why she was taking her cash out.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. I mean, nowadays an ATM card and a debit card are like the same thing, but right. They weren't always. I don't find the cash thing that unusual, just because even if she had a debit card, I believe there were places that didn't take debit card. So, like, it wasn't necessarily something that you would count on, especially if you're going to, like, someplace that's a little more out of the way. Cash is always just safer, but especially in 2004. You could always use cash.
Right, because it seems very strange now, because you can use debit cards anywhere.
Yeah.
But back in the day, you really couldn't.
It was definitely a thing to be like, oh, I got to get money from the ATM because I don't know if I'm going to be able to get to an ATM at the, like, place I'm going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, the next thing she did was go to Liquors 44 in the Stop and Shop Plaza, and she bought about $40 worth of alcohol. And there's been a lot of conflicting reports about what she bought and what was found in the car. But in the interview that Julie did in January, she was at least able to give us some definitive answers about what was found in the car.
Mm.
And that was a 12-pack of Sky Blue, a nip of Bailey's, and a box of wine.
Okay.
And in the past, I'd questioned whether or not the box of wine was open, because the police report didn't say that it was, but according to Julie, it was open. And Julie also said that not all of the alcohol that was in the car was purchased on the 9th. Some of it was purchased before. Mm-hmm. She also returned 79 cans and bottles and left the store at 3:43 p.m. And we know that because it's timestamped on the redacted receipt that the state police released.
For those who don't live in a state that has a bottle deposit, how much money do you get for 79 cans of bottles? That sounds like a lot of bottles, Aaron. That's
It's $3.95. And by the way, I actually put 79 cans and bottles of my own. I collected them and just to see like how big of a bag it was. It's about one full trash bag.
Yeah, that's what I'd expect. Now, what size bottles were you doing? Were you doing the 20 ounce or the...
I was doing mixes of cans and bottles. I would expect at UMass, it was probably weighted toward the cans of like Keystone Light.
Yep, Natty Ice. You gotta get the Natty Ice.
Yeah, and I don't want to speculate too much, but everyone else does. So I think what she may have done, which is what I did, is in the basement of each dorm, there's recycling. And they're in these big clear bags. And I would take the entire bag and go to Stop and Shop or somewhere else that had a bottle deposit and trade them in for like $5 when I was in college. So I was broke.
Yep.
So I suspect that maybe she figured out that trick as well.
You don't think those were her 79 cans of bottles?
The reason I don't actually think that they were is because there's an article by Kelly White in the Journal Opinion that describes somebody seeing her leaving the university with a backpack, a bag full of cans and bottles, and a box of wine.
Oh.
So if they were able to see what was in the bag, I assume that it was those like clear bags from the basement of the dorms, because in the pictures of her dorm room, she has some plastic trash bags and they're black. So unless the person has x-ray vision.
So she was stealing recyclables.
I used to do it too, though.
I wonder where she got the idea from, or where you got the idea from.
Actually, I think I got it from...
Oh, okay. That sounds about right.
Yeah, he was the one who sort of suggested it. And I was like panicked. I'm like, I don't know if we can do this. And I'm sure I had him like looking out.
That's really funny.
And making sure we didn't get caught. But yeah. And then after, I just kept doing it.
Yeah, that sounds about right. That the first time you were like, oh crap, can we do this? And then you're like, oh yeah, no, we could definitely do this.
Yep. Turns out no one gives a shit or is paying attention to anyone else but themselves.
Yeah.
One time, actually stole an entire 3-gallon tub of ice cream from the kitchen at UMass. Like, just walked into the kitchen and took it. And, like, nobody stopped him. Nobody tried to ask, like, hey, dude, what are you doing?
That's awesome.
And we all, like, went back and had, like, 20 people just, like, eat this huge tub of chocolate, peanut butter, frozen yogurt. Ooh, that's what it was.
Nice.
Anyway. The next thing is not an absolute certainty, okay, but it would kind of make sense for a few reasons. So between 3:55 and 4:30 p.m., it's possible that time was spent by Maura going to the Hadley police station and obtaining duplicate copies of the accident report from the wreck that she got into with her dad's car the previous weekend. And I say that because there were multiple references to Fred telling her that she had to go get the forms at the police station. The state of Massachusetts requires you to file this form within 5 days of any accident where there's more than $1,000 of damage. So you can get it at the DMV. You can also get it at police stations. The other reason is because in Sharon Rausch's notes, she's describing what was found in the Saturn. And she says two sets of running clothes, her running shoes, and a bag with her textbooks and assignments, along with duplicate sets of the Hadley police report from her accident on Saturday, February 7th.
Oh, okay.
So that's very specific, and it would make sense. It was what she said she was going to do. It's what her dad told her to do. And the Hadley police station is pretty close to Route 91, which is what you pick up to head north. So it's quite possible that, I would say likely, that she stopped at the Hadley police station before she left. The other thing is, Lieutenant Scorenza, who is the state police lieutenant in charge of her case for several years, said on like multiple occasions that she departed the Amherst-Hadley area around 4:30 p.m. Mm-hmm. And it's never been entirely clear to me why he said that, that time.
Right. Like, where'd he get that timestamp from?
Right. And she did call her voicemail at 4:37.
Okay.
So it's possible he had cell phone ping data and he was looking at towers. But it's also possible that he knew that she stopped at the Hadley police station because the forms were in the car.
Okay.
I did get in touch with the lieutenant at the Hadley police station right now, the current one, and he tried as hard as he could to figure out if he could determine whether that police report, like what time it was printed or anything that could help us, but he couldn't. It's just been too long.
Yeah, that's too bad.
Yeah. At least you tried helping.
Yeah. I wonder if you could you FOIA that? Could you be like, any references or mentions of the Hadley police station in Maura Murray's file?
I could try filing a right to know request, but I can tell you exactly what the response will be.
Yeah. At this point, you're getting the same response to everything.
Right. Over and over again.
Jesus.
Okay, so just a quick recap of the time between 3:32 a.m. and 4:37 p.m. on February 9th. At 3:32 a.m., Maura emails her homework to her nursing cohort. At 12:55 p.m., Maura made a three-minute call to Linda Salamone, the owner of a condo in Bartlett, New Hampshire, but she did not make a reservation. At 1 p.m., Maura emailed Bill. At 1:13 p.m., Maura called Aaron Murphy and said that she would be gone for a few days due to a family emergency and would be stopping by to drop off clothes that she'd borrowed. At 1:24 p.m., Maura emailed her professors and said there was a family emergency or a death in the family, and she'd be gone for a few days. At 2:05 p.m., Maura made a one-minute call to 1-877-GO-STOW. At 2:18 p.m., Maura called Bill, but he didn't pick up because he was on the other line. At 3:15 p.m., Maura stopped at the Fleet ATM in Amherst and withdrew $280. At 3:43 p.m., Maura left Liquors 44 in Hadley, Mass. After purchasing about $40 worth of alcohol. After 3:43, it's possible Maura stopped at the Hadley police station to obtain duplicate copies of the accident report and the Massachusetts Motor Vehicle Crash Operator report. And then at 4:37 p.m., Maura made a call to her voicemail that lasted 4 minutes. And that's the last record of any call in her phone records. So the next time we'll pick up from 4:37 p.m.
Okay.
But I just want to talk a little bit about episode 388 and 389. True Crime Garage covered the Leeko Kenny Bruce McKay case, which is tangential to the Maura Murray case, but it's probably what Bruce is the most famous or infamous for.
Yeah, that's why almost anyone knows who he is.
Right. Although he hasn't really been brought up all that much in the Maura Murray case, surprisingly. Somewhat surprisingly. Considering that he was clearly on duty and happened to, at least seems like he dropped everything the second that Maura's 911 call came in, or more accurately, 1 minute after, and then was off radio for a number of hours.
Yeah, to me, that is, I think we've talked about this before, that timing on him getting called off the other case, that is the most suspicious thing to me. That is the thing that makes me think, okay, maybe he was involved. Absent that, it's hard to draw a connection, but that is very interesting.
Right, because something clearly precipitated him clearing that call.
And there's nothing else in the logs it could be. So
right,
it's either that or it's something that's not captured in the logs that caused him to go off that case.
Yeah, because Maura's call was the only call that was happening. There was nothing else going on that he could have been going to. Right. So
yeah, so to people who like study the transcripts, he might be more well known, although not necessarily. I mean, he only would be if you noted the coincidental timing.
Mm-hmm. Which is hard to do in those logs.
Yeah, those logs are hard to understand. I mean, you spent a ton of time, right? Like decoding what all the symbols and, you know, the numbers are, who each thing represents. So it doesn't really surprise me that much. You kind of have to like connect the dots.
Yeah, yeah. I thought that True Crime Garage did a really good job of breaking down the Leeko Kenny, Bruce McKay incident, given how complicated it sort of is.
Yeah, well, it covered a lot of time, right? It wasn't just the one incident, it was their whole history.
Yeah, yeah, so which began 4 years earlier.
Yeah.
The one thing that I had somewhat of a difference of opinion on about was the idea that 36 hours was an adequate time to conduct an investigation into an incident that could very well have been first-degree murder.
Right. You're referring to Floyd shooting Leeko after Leeko shot McKay.
Right. Right. I think that I don't have the statement from New Hampshire State Police in front of me, but they closed that case, and I think it was 36 hours. And that's just not enough time to do any kind of real investigation. You can't investigate the simplest of misdemeanors in 36 hours, let alone a potential first degree murder.
Right. Yeah, I tend to agree. I mean, I don't have firsthand knowledge, but what strikes me as odd is that he wasn't charged at all. I mean, whether it took 36 hours or not, you should have been able to come to the conclusion that like it was very suspicious at a minimum that he shot Leeko under those circumstances. Whether someone feels like it's like cosmically justified or not, it seems to me a violation of the law. So to me, it's like it's very hard to not come to the conclusion that it was murder. If Floyd has a defense, that would be a very difficult one for me to like. He'd have to make a really good case as to why it was justified.
Yeah.
Again, legally, you know, some people might feel the fact that Leeko shot a cop, obviously, you know, he deserved to die or whatever. But like as citizens, normally we don't get to make those decisions. And usually the police like frown upon citizens making those decisions. So
usually outside of New Hampshire.
Yeah. Right. So just from a legal perspective, it does seem odd that they would so quickly decide there's nothing to see here, especially since Floyd was an ex-con. Usually if you're an ex-con, like that's a big red flag for the police. Usually they're all over you.
Right. And Casey Sherman notes this in his book, Bad Blood, which they reference on their episodes. Mm-hmm. He says, Ayotte's speedy decision to absolve Floyd of any wrongdoing is peculiar given the amount of prescription drugs in his system, his violent past, and the fact that he was forbidden by law from using a firearm.
Yeah.
So if that's the case, then even just using McKay's firearm would have been one charge in itself. And again, perhaps justified, maybe he's proven not guilty, but still... to not even conduct any kind of investigation. And it reminds me of, what's the phrase? It's like, the absence of evidence isn't evidence of absence.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, it's like saying, the cigarette company saying, there's no reason to believe that cigarettes are bad for you because we didn't do any kind of study or investigation
right
into the matter. Therefore, we have no reason to believe that they can hurt you. You know what I mean? Or like a drug company saying that we have no evidence that it has any negative side effects without doing any actual testing to see.
Yeah, I mean, so what, you think they actually didn't look into Floyd? Because to me, it's like, you have the evidence right there. I mean, the evidence was apparent. We know what he did. It's weird to me that they would exonerate him. It's like they took his word for it, that it happened exactly the way he said it did, and that his motivations were what he said they were. But it's like, well, but why would you think that?
Right.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. They didn't do an investigation. I mean, seems apparent to me, given the fact that they didn't even interview some of the police that were on scene until weeks later, days later, weeks later. So how do you conclude an investigation before you even speak to the people that were on scene?
Yeah. Well, how do you investigate the disappearance of a missing girl if you haven't even interviewed like her family members?
Fair point.
I mean,
yeah.
But in a case where they have a lot of reason to not want to dig any deeper because, hey, the guy killed someone who killed the cop, so what are we even bothering with this for? You know, it's like a cliche, but I can just picture the scene in the movie where there's some like righteous district attorney who's like, but he killed somebody. He's a ex-felon who shot a civilian. His life wasn't in danger. How could we have to investigate? And they're like, what are you talking about? He killed McKay. He deserved what he got. You want to investigate him? What's wrong with you? You know, like, I mean, that obviously that conversation probably didn't happen like that, but in a more subtle, restrained way. I'm sure a conversation almost exactly like that happened. You know, police are human beings. DAs are human beings. They have motivations and biases and maybe even unconscious impulses, just like any of us would. So if they were emotional about the fact that a police officer died, that could have affected their judgment. It would be crazy for it not to have.
I agree. I just, you have to have accountability at some level. And I think that the person signing off on that report was the Attorney General of New Hampshire, the highest law enforcement officer in the state, Kelly Ayotte. So I'm sorry, that's her job.
Yeah. If someone's not looking out for what the actual law is, not putting aside emotions and feelings and just focusing on the law, who's it going to be if not the Attorney General?
Exactly.
It's a concern.
But, you know, she had a Senate race to run, so... Don't want to piss off the police.
Well, certainly if you're running for Senate and you are trying to get district attorneys to prosecute someone who shot a cop killer, yeah, that's probably not going to go well for you.
Right.
Not saying that that's what happened, of course. We don't know, but it does make you think. But some people would say, well, who cares? Who cares? So Floyd shot a guy who shot a police officer. Didn't he get what he deserved? Wasn't justice served? That's what some people would say.
And I would respond by saying, we don't know because there was never any investigation nor any kind of trial where justice could be arbitrated.
Right. So that we kind of get to, you know, what actually happened. You know, like my question from day one, the second I saw that video, what was it, 3 years ago, however many years ago that you got me into this. My question was, well, what the hell is McKay doing? Like, why does he walk up to Lico Kenny's car and pepper spray him?
Yeah.
What was that? And all of that got wiped out because of what happened subsequently. But the question still remains. And because there wasn't a deeper investigation, we won't know, or we don't know.
Right. Even if you concede that McKay was a bad apple, he was just one bad apple. Mm-hmm. You know what they say about bad apples, right?
They spoil a bunch?
Yes.